Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Worldwide Soba, restaurant consulting, noodle factory, and academy. For more information, visit worldwide-soba.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we are broadcasting from the International Culinary Center. And my guest is actually one of our alums, who maybe a chef's name you're not so familiar with, but all of you know. And probably he probably is the longest serving chef at the Food Network, Rob Blyfer, who's the executive chef of the Food Network for over 20 years. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it too. And you also serve as our adjunct dean of food media here, teaching about food media. And I know that a lot of our listeners are really interested in understanding what it is you do and what is the magic of the Food Network. I mean, it really has taken the whole world by storm, and there's copycat channels all over the world. And this program actually is listened to in 200 different countries. So
I'll be sure not to swear in another language.
It's internet radio. You can do whatever you want. Well, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
So I know that you're a Jersey boy from Seacliff.
Oh, actually, well, I'm a Long Island boy. There is a Jersey Seacliff, but I'm the New York Seacliff.
Oh, my gosh. I just presumed, you know, it was a Bruce Springsteen backwater there.
I'm the Seacliff that nobody knows about. It's the best kept secret of Long Island.
Really?
I guess where is it on Long Island? It's up on the North Shore. So we're on the same little peninsula that Oyster Bay and Glencove are on.
Oh, nice.
So people know those. We're 5 minutes from Roslyn, 15 minutes, basically, I mean, a mile as the crow flies, but you have to go around the harbor to get to Port Washington. So we're in an area that everybody knows. But other than people who grew up there, nobody knows about Seacliff.
So I know you went to Food and Finance High School. Was that in that area?
Yeah, Food and Finance, I didn't attend there. We've just been supporting it.
Oh, I've got all the wrong information.
No, Food Network, I want to say it's close to 10 years now that we were introduced to this high school that's just an amazing, amazing place. So Food Network has given support both financially through sponsoring externships for some of their seniors before they go off to the real world, and we help them with their annual fundraiser.
It's part of the New York City school system.
Yeah, and it's an amazing school. I mean, how many high schools anywhere, let alone here in the city, have hydroponic gardens, a fish farm, the off waste of which feeds the hydroponic gardens, all as part of their curriculum? It is
an amazing place. That's so incredible. I know we work with them as well. There's a big gala coming up in a couple of weeks.
I guess I'll see you there.
Yeah. But let's get back to you.
Okay.
All right. So I'm so glad you're here. So where did you grew up in on Long Island?
Yeah, I grew up on Long Island. Well, I didn't grow up there. I grew up on the South Shore in the town of Woodmere.
Long Island.
Yeah, on Long Island, you know, was raised there, loved life there, and, you know, it certainly started to change, as a lot of Long Island did, and eventually was very happy to get out. You know, went off to college.
Did you surf?
I did not surf. We spent an awful lot of time at the beach, but that was before surfing was a little more mainstream, and not that I would not have been happy to do something outside of the norm, but my friends didn't surf, my friends didn't.
So what were you, when you were in high school, what did you think you were going to do in life?
Well, shortly before high school, I thought I was just going to, you know, follow daddy's footsteps, and my father was an orthopedist, and I just sort of assumed that's what I was going to do until one afternoon he took me to a Yankees game, and he was paged, and again, this is way pre-cell phone and anything else, and his beeper went off, and found a payphone and made the call, and he had to swing by one of the emergency rooms, and rather than take me home and go back and lose an hour with someone in pain, it's like, oh, come by. And it was a broken arm, which I guess they kind of knew it was when they called him. And he knew it wasn't anything gruesome, so why don't you come in? Like, okay. And there's this adorable little 2-3-year-old girl who fell off the swings in the playground. And the x-ray goes up, and I knew enough reading x-rays. I'm like, oh, look at that. She broke both her radius and her ulna, and they're sticking out in different directions, and they're going to have to set her arm. And my father is looking at the x-ray and looking at her arm and has a hold of it and sets her arm. And it made this horrible crunching of chicken bones being crunched. And it didn't make me sick as in, oh, my God, I'm going to lose my lunch. But it just like felt like I got kicked in the gut. Just that sound just rock through me, and from that moment on it was, I am not following in daddy's footsteps. And I asked him about it. He's like, oh, what'd you think? And I said, oh, the sound. And he was so numbed out to the sound, he never heard it. He just knew this is how you set an arm. And I didn't want to get numbed out to that. I didn't want to do that. And then, of course, fast forward 10 years or whatever it was to standing in the level one kitchen, and Chef Dennis drops veal kidneys into my hand. So I'm like, I didn't want to hear the sound of crunching bones, and now look what I'm playing with. So, you know.
Well, so you were a photographer. And yeah, right, that, so tell us, so, where, what did you do after Woodmere?
Okay, so when I left high school, I went off to college, became an economics major, and assumed Wall Street's my next move.
Where'd you go to college?
Union College up in Schenectady.
Okay.
So I assumed,
not New Jersey.
No, there is
there
a Union.
There is a Union, I know.
Yeah,
I
see,
know.
It's all these parallels. So again, it's like, I'm going to Wall Street. That's where I'm going. And I decided I needed to take off that one last summer after college, that this would be my last summer off being a kid, so to speak, forever and ever until I retired. So traveled cross country with my best friend, and still took me a little while to get my act together, and I finally start getting my resume out there, and my first interview in New York City happened to be the second business day after the market crash. And I spent all of the prior day waiting for the phone call saying, don't come in. So I have an interview, and I have to say, I mean, I was not
who
a good...
Who is it with?
I can't even remember the company,
no.
But I was not a very good interviewee at the time. I was just way too nervous, and I was so relaxed because I knew I was not getting hired. And at the end of the interview, do you have any questions? I said, yeah. I assume there's some form of hiring freeze, and there's really no point being here today. And he goes, yeah, there's a hiring freeze, but we didn't want to cancel on you. So I spent a good few months spinning wheels trying to figure out what to do, since my career path had just all of a sudden come to a complete and utter end before it ever started. And all through high school, I love photography. And then in college, I really got into it and discovered that photography could be a true art form instead of more documenting life in some respect. And I was totally bitten by the bug, but never saw it as this should be your career. And I happened to be in an art gallery, and my father knew the owner, and of course he's pushing her buttons about, oh, you know, take a look at his portfolio. So I show up an hour later, and she had the son of a very famous oil painter who was an artist in his own right. And the two of them are looking at my work, and he just looked at me and said, oh, you need to go get your master's, and you need to be at RIT in the spring or in the fall. And I just sort of swept up in this, oh my God, these guys are saying I'm good, I should do this. And I went and signed up to get a master's in photography, not even really knowing where an end game would take me. And I think I could safely say it was one of the greatest, not that that was a career going to school, but one of the greatest career mistakes I've ever made.
Career mistakes? Why? Did you love photography?
I love photography. The faculty there, when I was a student there, especially in the graduate program, was a complete and utter disaster.
Really?
I mean, the program was in a shambles. We didn't find out until after were all in our first year that I think it was 2 years ahead of us. The students got together and sued the school, and they brought in a new professor. And again, the program was a disaster. So I still loved making art. And as an artist, I mean, I grew measurably and learned incredible life lessons that I could not have learned anywhere else and grew as a person. Uh-huh. But they literally got me to hate taking pictures. And while I think I was waiting for my thesis show to officially have the rubber stamp, you know, on it, and yes, here's your diploma, and I'm working a freelance job documenting this artist's work who was displayed. It was a big prize he won. His work was in the windows of Saks, and he wanted, or sorry, Bloomingdale's, and he wanted the document of his work in the windows. And I'm standing on the street corner with the easiest job of a lifetime, and all I kept thinking was, I am so miserable looking through the lens of a camera right now. And all through grad school and even, you know, back to my teens and earlier, I just always loved food. And some of my best friends in grad school, we would have these Friday and or Saturday night dinner parties where we would just tag team cook and just really up the ante of what each other was cooking. And it was about this time that they invited me for dinner and we cooked and they poured me a big glass of single malt and I've got a nice buzz working. And they're like, okay, so look how happy you are when you cook. I'm like, yeah, I know. And how miserable are you with your camera right now? I'm like, yeah, pretty miserable. And they said, look, your artwork, and they pointed up to a piece of my work that was hanging on their wall, said, you are so talented. Your work is never coming off our wall, but you are so miserable doing this. You should really think about it.
These were your friends that
yeah.
were...
Okay. And these people, I'll give them credit, you know.
They pushed you.
Ed Minnick and Patty Rosati, thank you for the push.
Yes.
So they gave me the push down the road, and I really took it to heart and worked in a couple of nowhere restaurants just to kind of barely dip the toe in the water, and then took a summer job working at a restaurant in the Hamptons that, thankfully, you know, connections. One of my best friends from college, his father had owned two restaurants out in the Hamptons forever. And one of them, they needed someone in the kitchen, and I worked out that 3 nights a week, I worked the kitchen. 3 nights a week, I was the host working front of the house and got to really see
really
both sides
it.
Of
yeah.
it. And I was lucky. Just still fully bitten by the bug. I knew it's what I needed to do. Worked at another nowhere restaurant before I decided, okay, you know, I need that piece of paper on the wall. And, of course, at the time, I thought I knew so much, and this was just to get the piece of paper and get my foot
Why
in the door.
Why did you feel like you needed the piece of paper? Because a lot of people today say just go work in a restaurant. Is it a different time? Or
I think it was a different time that back then, I mean, Food Network didn't exist yet. Chefs, you know, even the TV chefs were more, I shouldn't say personalities, but, you know, it was Julia Child, Galloping Gourmet. I'm not even sure if when I was a kid if Jacques was on yet, but these weren't sort of the chefs of today, and I kind of thought if I'm going to open a restaurant or work in a restaurant, I needed that street cred to get me in the door.
And how long have you worked in restaurants at this stage?
At that point, it was, I mean, on and off 6-9 months when I decided, okay, you know what, I need
to get serious.
I need that. Yeah. And again, I came here thinking I was just going to fine-tune my skills.
Well, let's say the French Culinary Institute.
Yes,
which
the French
is now,
Culinary.
Yeah, we grew into the international. But you are an alum from 94?
94.
Yeah.
So I thought I was just going to fine-tune and polish, and was, oh my God, I know so little about this field. Thank God I'm here. And, you know, I look back.
Like what? I mean, because you were already cooking in kitchens.
I cooked, but I mean, so my knife skills were, in retrospect, horrible. I didn't properly hold a knife. I held a knife like a home cook instead of like a chef. And ingredients and techniques that, you know, I thought I knew, I either wasn't quite right or just hadn't seen techniques yet because they weren't on all of the shows because there weren't so many shows. So week one was, you know, oh my God, thank the Lord, I am here. This is amazing. And I loved every minute of it. At the end of the 6 months, I was shocked that you could actually learn that much about food in a six-month period.
Yeah.
And then...
A little different from RIT.
A little different, yes. Much more positive. Yeah. And even with, you know, the drill sergeant chef Dennis, yeah. who made people literally cry and pee their pants, you know, I knew immediately Chef Dennis, like, he was... he played the role. He yeah. just felt like you're going to go to the restaurant, someone is going to yell and scream at you and kick your butt, and he was getting us ready for that. Right. So from that through the more kind and gentle, you know, chef instructors, I just soaked it all in and volunteered for every possible after school class and demo just to, I mean,
I read something about you, and you referred to Dan Barber being in the class above you, and you saw him. What was your quote about him?
Oh, I can't even remember what my quote was.
It struck me because, you know, I know him quite well, and you said he didn't care about having friends.
Oh, yeah. He was one level ahead of me. So when I was in, and this was when French was still a four-level program.
Yeah.
I was level three. He was level four. So my partner and I were the assistants on his station. And he really did.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
tell
so
me
we
that.
Were his assistants. And he really, he was just focused on his education. And he didn't give a damn if you liked him or not. He didn't see anything as a popularity contest or I need your friendship for whatever. It's either he thought you were a friend or not. And he just was getting the work done. And that was it. And
focus.
Right. Yeah, and again, it's not like he was being a jerk, but.
No.
You know, that was Dan. And, and again, we still look, I look back at everyone in my class and the class ahead and the class behind, and no one would ever voice it, but we all looked at each other thinking, you're not going anywhere. Not about Dan, but just everyone in the class, like, they're going nowhere.
I know.
You're going nowhere. Who are you?
Hey, Bobby Flay was voted the least likely to succeed in his class. I mean, because he was only 19, you know, and so he was a little, let's say, unfocused. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Worldwide Soba, Restaurant Consulting, Noodle Factory, and Academy. Buckwheat noodles, also known as soba, contain a variety of nutrients that are natural and healthy additions to one's diet. Not only are they excellent for mental and digestive health, they're also believed by many around the world for having properties that prevent lifestyle diseases. Currently, Worldwide Soba is consulting 35 kinds of Japanese restaurants in the United States. Visit their website for more at worldwide-soba.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. It's Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is the executive chef of the Food Network, Rob Blyfer. And so, Rob, tell me how... So you got out of school, and what was your first job, and then how do you become the executive chef of the Food Network? I'm sure everyone is dying to hear about this.
Yeah, so much of it was just being in the right place at the right time. So while I was a student, I spent Saturdays trailing, I think it was five Saturdays over the course of 2 months, I trailed at Oriole. And at the time, like, I forgot how I got my foot in the door, but it was, wow, Charlie Palmer, I want to work for him at Oriole. And I finished my fifth trail and meet with one of his sous who really, you know, ran the day-to-day of the kitchen for him. I said, look, we really like you. You're doing a great job, but I could hire you at that rate, or I can hire the intern from CIA at half the comics. We're going there. It's nothing personal. If you want, you can trail for a day down at Kitchen 22, which we kind of treat as the minor leagues. So I agreed and went and trailed down there and hated it. I just had no respect for the chef who was there at the time and just like, I'm not working there. Forget. That's not how I'm going to get in. And it was, I think, 2 days after graduation, Chef Alon calls me in.
Chef Alon was our dean of students, culinary dean here. So
and I can't remember who
called. Oh, so you were trailing at Oriole while you were in
school. That was while I was a student, okay. And I graduated and didn't have the job lined up yet and checking the job listings every day. And then I get the call to come meet Chef Alon. I get the, Robert, there is a job for you. You are going to trail. You are going to get the job. It is at Park Avenue Cafe. David Burke, yes. You will ask for Jimmy Anderson, and you will get this job. Yes? I said, yes, Chef, I will. And I will say that David Burke next to Charlie Palmer, I mean, that was it. I was so thrilled and, of course, so terrified of going into that kitchen.
Right.
But thankfully, school prepared, you know, gave me the skill set to trail. Trailing those five Saturdays really prepared me for what working in a real restaurant kitchen was like. And I showed up, and of course, I asked for Jimmy Anderson, only to discover that That's Alon's accent, and it was Jimi Henderson. Like, okay, we're not starting off on a good foot here, but I had a great trail, and David Burke's kitchen there was run by two teams of two sous. So I had to show up the next day, do another all-day trail for the other team of sous chefs, got the job, was there just short of a year when I just, and I had no idea that the reputation of that kitchen in particular was one of the roughest in the city. It was my first city job. I thought they were all like that. And
so define rough. What made it so rough?
Forgetting the crazy long hours that most of us went through. David's sous chefs literally were like death camp guards. And there was just, you know, the obscenities that, you know, would make a truck driver blush and the insults and whatever. And at least one of his teams of two, I knew it was just like Chef Dennis here. They're just pushing you to make you be the best, which means their food is going to be better and better. And it was the other team that one of them in particular was just borderline psychotic. And I just felt like I could not learn from them. So in my mind, there was one afternoon that it's like, okay, I'm done at this restaurant, but I'm going to figure out the next step and the end game before I give notice. And I still left there without knowing who I was going to work for next. And I decided, you know what? Like, I'm not learning. I'm miserable. Let me go pick up some freelance work and I'll find out who my next chef is. So I was working in an executive kitchen down on Wall Street, came back here. I need more work. Oh, call Food Network. So at this point,
so it was through the school.
Yeah. So Food Network wasn't even 2 years old yet. I didn't know it was based here in New York. They didn't even have a phone number for me. They just had a contact name. So I had to, you know, call 411. There was no Googling Food Network to find out anything. So I called. It took a good few weeks to get the interview and then another few weeks of pushing to get in the door for that first day. And even still today, as chef, I am so not wanting to bring in that rookie for that first day, just knowing the training. And I know clearly how I tortured the original sous chef back then to get me in the door.
Right.
So they finally got me in and it just clicked. And within 2-3 weeks, I was working 5-7 days a week freelancing there. And that was my only freelance
work. Did they
work.
Have an executive chef at that time?
We did, although about the time I started was when she transitioned from really being sort of hands-on with food. And her role at the time was the team in the kitchen would prep the food. She spent the entire day on set and when Harriet inherit all of the prepped food. That was what she did. And she was getting so busy planning as the network was growing that she couldn't do that anymore. So we had two sous chefs and our chef, Susan Stockton. So I started picking up all this freelance work, and probably about 6 weeks in, they propositioned me with a full-time job, which wasn't going to start until February. So today, February 1st, is literally my 20-year anniversary of full-time work at Food Network.
Wow, today. Congratulations. Well, so you have... So tell me, what is it... Well, first of all, when you started, were they on 10th Avenue back then?
No, this was... We were on the 31st floor of 1177, which I think it's changed names. It used to be the Price Waterhouse building.
Uh-huh.
So 31 flights up, an all-electric kitchen, all-electric studio. There was no gas anywhere. And it was just... crazy. The entire refrigeration for all of Food Network for the first 6-7 years was a bank of 8 home-sized GE refrigerators, the classic old white box, 3 electric 4-burner ranges, and that was where every bit of food came out of.
How many shows were there on those days?
Oh, I couldn't even remember how many we had on, but that was when every show was, you know, the in the kitchen, the how-to style show with the chef behind the counter, and depending on who it was, we were shooting anywhere from 5-7 episodes a day.
No.
It was...
How do you do the prep for that? And how many days a week?
It was shooting pretty much 7 days a week.
No.
I mean, the motto back then was build a library. Everybody knew we just needed content to get on the air and keep the network going. So, I mean, Emeril, we used to do 7 episodes of Essence of Emeril a day with 5 of us prepping. So you would do a full show, which... I mean, it was a lot of work, and there would be 2 shows waiting in the middle of the table for whoever finished first to start picking up. And it was always me and this other guy, Moise, who I believe was an alum of here as well. But Moise and I were always the first one done, and we'd get stuck two shows a day. Finally, other people would jump in and help us prep, and it was just crazy, but it was fun. The hours were way shorter than restaurant work. I was no longer doing 70 hours in 5 days. And it was exciting. I never thought test kitchen. I didn't even really knew what it was. And even though it was called a test kitchen, it was not a test kitchen. It was a production kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But they offered me the job. And at the time, I'm like, okay, every chef and restaurateur in the tri-state area comes through this kitchen. It's 15 paid vacation days and instant health benefits instead of work for the year before you can negotiate those things. So it's like, okay, you know what? I will meet exactly who I'm going to work for, and at least in the meantime, health and
sure.
3 weeks of vacation. I mean, that's unheard of. So I did this thinking, okay, I'll do it for 2 years. I'll have clearly met my next boss, whoever's going to kick my butt next. I know who it's going to be. At the end of 2 years, I was still learning so much and loving it. It became three. It became four. And then my fifth year, learning curve was slowing down. Not that I'd done everything, but I had really seen and done everything that we were doing. I traveled with shows and led productions on the road. We took Emerald Live to Chicago and Orlando, and it just seemed like it had run its course. So my five-year review was 5 days before my birthday, and our then SVP propositioned me. She's like, oh, come out to lunch. And she was being really squirrely. And if you've ever met Susan Stockton, she is not a jumpy, squirrely person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, let's order wine. And wine comes, she takes a sip, she literally like slams her glass. There's like, I just have to get something out right now. Don't answer. It's like, I want you to be my chef. And it was literally like a scene in a cheap movie that everything around me slowed down. And all of a sudden, just this perfect clarity of, yeah, I'll do that. And slowly everything sped back up to normal speed. And I looked at her and she's like, don't answer. I said, I'm answering. I'll take it. And some other questions came out. And still at the time, I never thought I'm going to do this forever. But it's coming up on 15 years now that I've been running the kitchen.
Wow.
And I really only half-heartedly joke that pretty much this year I'm starting my fourth completely different job in the same exact role. Just because what we do has morphed and evolved so much, not just in the 20 years I've been there, but in the 15 years I've been running the kitchen, that it's kept it fresh. It's still exciting and challenging and ever-changing.
We're going to get right to that, but I'm going to take another break here so the next time we can just run with it. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Rob Blyfer, the executive chef of the Food Network. And he's also our adjunct dean of food media, teaching food media here at the International Culinary Center. So, Rob, there are four incarnations of the Food Network from your point of view.
I wouldn't even say that there are four official, but even when
walk us through those, because we're all, you know, fans.
Yeah. I mean, when I started running the kitchen, probably 95% of what we did was the food for the shows. And at that point, we were slowing down a little, and it wasn't build a library. Doesn't matter if there are smudges on the bowls or there's a chip bowl. Just
I got to ask you something. Not all chefs are born equal. Could you see, you know, when people came through, this is a great chef, or this person doesn't know what they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could see, and again, whether it's someone working with us in the prep kitchen or on-air talent, you can see who really has their chops. And even regardless of who has their chops, you can see who can do this on camera and who can't. And I have to say, regardless of someone's ability to chop and saute and like all the little culinary notes, it is truly one in a million that can do that on camera and be natural about it. Because we used to do a show, I'm sure this hasn't seen the light of day in 10 years, if not 15, called Chef du Jour. And we would shoot 5 episodes in a day, so it could air Monday through Friday, and it was a different chef coming in filming. And they spent an entire day in the studio doing their 5 episodes. mostly New York City area, although some national. And for the most part, these poor, unsuspecting folks did not ever have a single minute of media were thrown in. And, I mean, some of the best chefs in America at the time, they could clearly execute the food for camera, but getting them to look at the camera, say their things, and not have this be the most painful experience of their lives as well as everyone else in the room. You know, you could see that, but there would be that one where, oh, look at that. They're actually being kind of natural on camera, and yeah, they're looking at the floor manager instead of looking at the camera, and obvious, easy to fix mistakes, but you could see those things. Even, you know, Rachel Ray, her first day, she literally on her sort of demo, she was on the Emra live set, and she literally almost burnt the set down. That we back then, the way things went, yeah, you know, if someone had a saute, you put their pan on the heat and you turned the heat on, and presumably 5 minutes later they would get to it, and we would always say, look, your pan is going to be screaming hot, probably pull it off for 30 seconds before you put the oil in, but if your pan's not hot, you're not going to cook. And these were the days it was live to tape. It's not like, you know, some of the shows now, they shoot real time and someone turns on a burner and they just stand there and wait for a minute while the burner gets hot, and they'll chit chat and maybe some of that ends up on camera, maybe not. So we preheated pans and we walked her through and I said, okay, your pan is going to be screaming hot, pull it off for 30 seconds, then proceed like normal. And she was so nervous at everything happening around her. She put the oil in, the pan immediately ignited, and she's holding this flaming pan.
Did you get, you got, that was live, huh?
And this was it. And, you know, she still jokes. She's like, I almost burnt down the set of Emra Live, but they still took me. And, you know, but you could see in this, you know, unknown little girl from upstate that she just had that something that was going to carry through.
So you said that there were sort of four, you know, evolutions.
Yeah, so when I started, everything was the food for the shows,
right?
Or almost everything. And a little bit was, you know, Bobby would be on the CBS early show, so we would go there and set him up. But beyond that, I mean, that was what we did. And it was food for the shows, food for the shows. And then some other things started creeping in, and we started doing some of our in-house catering. And I do specify in-house. Nobody call and say, you got a birthday party, Nate. So the catering picked up, and then the recipe development picked up, and all these things would just pop up. And the recipe development within a year of when my team got involved, and it's still, we have a full team separate from what I do of recipe developers. But for about 2 years running, my guys were doing 500 recipes a year for Food Network, which was, I mean, we probably crept up to about 25% of the overall total.
So what is it? The chef comes in and says, these are the things that I want you to make. Here's my recipe? Or do you have to?
No, this, some of it for the magazine, some for things that go straight to the website.
Oh.
Then we even decided to streamline our in-house catering and have it be a little less of recipe written on a cocktail napkin and you walk somebody through service and go. And it was let's properly test these and have them truly ready for print, so that if I'm not there and a freelancer comes in, my sous chef isn't going to struggle to explain the scrawl on the napkin to get them to do it. But 500 recipes a year. And now, last year, my guys were probably down to about 250 as other projects and importances would kind of pop up. So it's just this ever-evolving kitchen.
So when they started doing the more reality and bringing amateurs in, how did that change the dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, some of it, I would say, you know, certainly some members of my team certainly miss working with, you know, the real chefy chefs on a daily basis. And thankfully, most of us, it's like, you know, we're not there to learn how, you know, Wolfgang Puck makes dish X. It's TV, it's production. Are you teaching? Are we entertaining? You know, we still have Bobby behind the counter, you know, doing brunch at Bobby's, so there are still chefs in the kitchen doing that. There are the competition shows where there really are, I mean, incredibly talented people competing, and then, you know, we get worst cooks celebrities, that it's a whole lot of fun, and yeah, it's an awful lot of work to build the pantry and set them up to make their disasters, but it's just a lot of fun watching it.
So what's been your favorite show over the years?
I think my favorite is still Iron Chef America. I mean, even the original Iron Chef Japan was so absurd with the Godzilla-style dubbing.
Yeah.
But Iron Chef America, just the excitement and energy of what happens in Kitchen Stadium to seeing true genius pop out of what they can do. And, you know, we certainly know the ingredients a month before they do. And I used to even challenge interns, like, okay, you know, there's going to be Battle Squid coming up. You have 3 days to give me your menu for Battle Squid. And still, even wouldn't have the conversation where it's like, okay, Battle Squid, what would I do? And kind of run through and have sort of feed off the excitement of the show a little bit. And then the part of Iron Chef that, I mean, I will never, ever forget, and most of my team still, the best day ever was the day before we would start to shoot. They would need a full tech dress rehearsal of Kitchen Stadium to make sure everything from every bit of cooking implement was working properly and that the gas pressure was enough to feed all the ranges and everything else, and that the salamanders and the deep fryers were working all the way through lighting and audio, and, you know, the little lady counting down with the 30 minutes remaining. So we would do a full tech dress rehearsal, and you're not going to get an Iron Chef to waste his time, and they're not going to allow a challenger to play in Kitchen Stadium for a day. So my team would split in two, and we would be chef and challenger. And it's just a tech rehearsal. The most deadly serious day of competition ever at Food Network. Every time Iron Chef would come back, we would do this for 3 days. People would be hiding in corners, testing out little bits of their recipe. And if you walked by and you were the other team, they would hide things. And we did at least keep it light with our ingredients. That was the one way we kept it light, where we did battle breakfast cereal, battle Spam, battle Cheese Whiz, battle Doritos and root beer and popcorn kernels. But I can
That's a good point. How much of the food is the star of the show? And how much is it the personality? And how much is it the technique?
Iron Chef, I think food is the star. And as much as Alton Brown is his twisted, brilliant genius up there, I still think of Iron Chef as about the food, where so many other shows, it is as much the personality as the food. And that's both, you know, whether it's a chef in the kitchen going back to, you know, the early Essence of Emerald through, you know, Bobby, who's still on air with us, or the LA celebrities from, you know, Valerie Bertinelli and Patty Heaton. It's still as much of the personality as the food. You know, Emerald, who, you know, we sort of built each other. And I say we, Food Network, not me.
Yeah.
You know, from the origin of the BAM and making food TV exciting, even though it's just a chef behind a counter cooking, through, again, the competition and the personalities, it was always as much about the two. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly when I was a kid and the cooking shows on TV, more people were watching to learn how to cook rather than to be entertained. And
do you ever want to go in front of the camera?
I constantly go back and forth with that. That when I got there, no. And I was, I mean, a terrible stage fright kind of person. Putting me in front of a crowd was nothing I ever, ever wanted to do. And was sort of forced into it a couple times in life. And by the time I got to Food Network, I was comfortable sort of public speaking, but never put me in camera. And that's not why I started there. That's not why I planned on staying 2 years, let alone 20. But never thought about it. And then at some point, watching all of these guys do it and sort of learning and seeing all the tricks of, you know, you're not looking at the floor manager, you're seeing her hold up the signs, counting down the minutes left in the segment and knowing where to look and follow the light and remember your food. It's like, okay, I can do this. And I pitched a show way back when that sadly for me, they pretty much went with the format and pulled in another host, which, you know, whatever, That's how the cookie crumbles. But I ended up on air with plenty of cameos. I joked that for the longest time I was the Where's Waldo of Food Network, that if you watch long enough you'd see me somewhere. And it started with appearances on In Food Today way, way, way back when. I was a regular judge on the Challenge series for a while, and then lots of interviews and other things.
So on the programs that travel around the country, or Bobby going out to do his challenge, do you have to go out, or your people have to go out with them?
And I certainly used to go. You know, I was Ming's guy.
You're a Ming's guy.
That when Ming started with East Meets West in our kitchen, in the main studio, I was his guy. And then when Ming's Quest became the show, where he traveled coast to coast, north to south, I was his guy. And I would pick up local food support from purchasers to an assistant prepper and we would go, and we still follow that model with a lot of the shows we do, that we send, and the teams that we send, it used to be we would send a full team. If I needed three or four people cooking and purchasing to make it happen, we'd usually pick up a local purchaser who knew the scene, but three or four of us would go, we'd do the food, they'd put us up in a hotel for the week or two or whatever it was. And now we work a lot more streamlined, that most cities we know we can find people capable of prepping the food, but we send a culinary producer and one of my stylists to be the leads on the show.
How big is your staff?
I have a team of five, including my sous chef, who has probably gotten
which
a lot
for
more.
For all of those shows, how many shows a week do you do?
I couldn't even give you a number that way, but it is it's a ridiculous amount of food that comes through the five of us.
Wow.
It's crazy. But again, that's what keeps it fun and exciting.
Fun and exciting. So, you know, last year you joined ICC as our adjunct dean of food media, and that grew out of a real need here. There's a lot of people who come to cooking school. In the old days, everyone came because they wanted to work in a restaurant, but today there's so many different areas that you can go into, from food policy and school food to working at the Food Network. But what we noticed is people come in with ridiculous ideas of what they can do when they graduate. And we needed doses of reality, the Chef Dennises of the media world. So tell me, what is it that you teach here? What is it that somebody who wants to get on the Food Network or be a media star, what is it that you're imparting as wisdom and teaching?
Yeah, so far I've taught just two classes. I did a media training class and then a recipe writing class. And, you know, each of which so important. Again, I mentioned earlier about un-media trained chefs who are, I mean, brilliantly talented chefs, all of a sudden being put in front of a camera, not knowing where to look, what, I mean, it's walking and talking at the same time, which again, we all take for granted, but it's that, you know, can you chew gum and walk and talk at the same time without literally falling on your face? And it's trying to give some tips and tricks. And, you know, it was kind of a really fun format where I was able to, you know, give my 30-minute spiel and bullet points of do's and don'ts. And then we had three students each do a demo. And they certainly knew their recipe and were rehearsed, but it was the, okay, you know, you've never done it for camera, and, you know, here's Chef Dennis watching, and you're going to get a nice critique when we're done. So it was really interesting, and the one who went third clearly got to see and hear a little bit more, and you can see whether it was just her natural ability or not, but you can kind of see a focus all of a sudden popping through. And then recipe writing, which, I mean, I think we all, I shouldn't say all, but, you know, most of us take for granted in the industry that you think, oh, you can just write it down and you don't have to test it, or you're just kind of taking notes while you're cooking and there's a recipe. And it is so much harder than that, to write a recipe that someone who has never seen you, met you, had a conversation with you, can pick up that piece of paper or turn to page 49 in your book and cook something and have the result come out just like yours.
So do you do all the recipes for the magazine and the website now?
No, we have a team of five who literally, at the most insane pace I've seen anywhere in the industry.
This is your five people?
This is a different five.
Oh, this is a different five. Okay.
Because at Food Network, we used to officially refer to the test kitchen and production kitchen. And I think for many good reasons, they decided to stop referring to it as Food Network kitchens, plural, that it is one harmonious, beautiful kitchen with a team of recipe developers and a production team who does so much more than production. So my team is the production team. And then we have a team of five developers who all day, every day, pretty much do nothing but develop the original content. And most of that is going into the magazine. So they roughly are doing 100 original recipes per issue. And then there's about 30 talent issues alongside of that that they are then cross-testing. That the deal, whether it's a show or the magazine, whoever the on-air talent is, you are delivering, theoretically, bulletproof, perfectly developed and tested recipes. But because these are going to print in a magazine, we still do a final cross-test on all, I say we, the testing team.
The
developers, they are doing that final test. And it doesn't matter, old guard, you know, Bobby Rachel Anna Jada Alton, or Eddie.
You say that like, no.
Yeah. Or Eddie, who won Food Network Star last year. It doesn't matter who it is. Their recipes get cross-tested to make sure they really are ready for print. Because while it would be mortifying for a Food Network kitchen recipe to fail, you put Jada's face on the cover and her cover recipe fails, that's, you know, an epic event. So we make sure, and not that the recipes ever would, of course, but we make sure that their recipes really are ready for, and again, I keep saying we, the team of developers who are just amazing.
Yeah, I love it because you are part of a team, you know, and then to have a sense that you're the DNA of the company, the Food Network, it's really quite heartwarming. You know, to see that you're so invested. We're actually running out of time.
Uh-oh.
And I can't believe it. It just like whipped by. But I have a question. What can we expect to see? You know, I think we've seen it all now on TV. There's so many TV shows. There's so many copies. And, you know, even Food Network Canada and Food Network India. What's going to be new? What can we look forward to?
Yeah, what's new is a good question. I mean, certainly there's always new talent appearing. And it may be a similar concept to a show that was 12 years ago, but all of a sudden you bring a completely new face and put the show in a new setting. And it now hashing all the old themes. So some of the styles and maybe a format is, you know, new competition shows. It's the new person. And again, right now there seem to be a little more of the LA celebrities getting in there, and you're kind of getting the peek behind the curtain of what it's like to be a celebrity cooking. I mean, whoever thought we would have Patty Heaton, right? The mom from Everybody Loves Raymond in the middle on air with us cooking. So there's some of that. And now a lot more is my team, as well as our kitchen in general, developing content for the digital world. So our website will be ever expanding, and original content on the website, on our Facebook page, original content daily going on to Snapchat. So a lot of things like that are becoming sort of the brave new world for us, in addition to still it's TV. It's our guys appearing on other network talk shows, and, you know, it's a crazy mix.
And you have another channel, right?
Yeah, cooking channel.
Yeah.
So cooking channel, yeah, a lot of the production execs and programming execs, there are Food Network staff, there are cooking channel staff doing it that way. As far as my team goes, we're one team.
So
one day we're supporting food,
the
next day we're supporting cooking, and it's, in that respect, it doesn't matter. It's just, it's a new face, new show.
It sounds like you've rolled with the punches. You haven't aged at all either.
Oh, go on.
So
there's some gray.
So I can see where the 3 weeks of vacation. You still get 3 weeks? Or
oh,
after
it's more
20
now,
years?
After 20 years, yeah. I think I'm up to like 24 or 27 days off now.
Oh, good for you. So where are you going on your vacation this year?
Oh, I break it up. I mix it up. Yeah, my wife, born and raised in Kentucky, so there's always a couple of weeks a year down in there, which then I get to escape to bourbon country and escape the in-laws.
So, well, that's good. And you have children?
I do. I have two little girls. My eldest is 9 and a half, and my baby turns 6 next week.
So this is a notorious profession for really raising a family. Have you found that having the job you have has made it more easier to be a father and a husband?
Yeah, certainly being in a production kitchen or test kitchen, whichever name you want to throw at it, really allows much more of a work-life balance. That for me, on really bad, busy weeks, I'm home late 2 nights a week instead of 5 or 6 or 7 nights a week.
Right.
And even then, I'm home late. I get home at 11 instead of at 11 o'clock, you're starting to break down your station so you can get home at 1. So the hours are so much more manageable. And even if the stress at time goes through the roof, because it's not just the food has to be perfect. The food has to be perfect at exactly the right time to appear before the camera. And it's not like in a restaurant, they call the fire on table 32 and you know exactly you have 5 minutes to get your plate up and match all the other plates on the line so no one's food is dying in the window. With us, in theory, at 10:15, the souffles have to be risen and ready to come out of the oven on set. Well, 10:15 comes along and you have a set of souffles perfectly risen and ready to go, but there were some production delays, and it's still 15 minutes away. So there are times where you would stagger soufflés going into the oven every 4 minutes, and you have 16 batches of soufflés coming out to make sure they're perfect. And the stress of that has literally driven people to the tears that you often find in restaurants or in the old Chef Dennis days. You would get that.
So my last question for you, because I know there's a lot of people listening to this saying, I would die to have a job there and to work for you. What's the ideal resume for someone who comes knocking on your door? What do you want to see? Who is that person?
Yeah, so I want to see someone who's been out in the field after school I mean, 1 year is the absolute minimum, but I really prefer two. I'll still drop it to one, thinking, okay, I realistically only had one. I can't be a jerk and not look at your resume because you didn't have that second year. But I still feel like 2 years in the field has really nailed home everything you could have possibly learned at school and made you fast and efficient and, you know, that machine. So that when I bring you in, I know you'll certainly be able to execute the food and we can kind of teach you the rest. And certainly anybody who's somewhere in there has the slightest little artistic background, knowing that we can teach them how to food style, someone who's certainly has to be able to, you know, speak loud and proud and not be bashful, because you're on set, there may be 30 faces watching and listening to everything you're saying, and you can't clam up, and you need to instill confidence in the show host as well as the culinary producer and the director and the executive producer of the show. So you need that ability to be loud and proud and emote and get it out there, as well as being a phenomenally talented cook.
Wow. Well, with that,
that's a lot.
Yes, it is. It is. Thank you so much. This has really been fascinating.
Yeah, this was great. This was about the fastest 45 minutes or however long we've been here. I can't believe it flew by. So
more.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming, and we'll see you next time.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.